Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Lick. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and pleased to be joined by Carl Bayer. Today, Carl is the proprietor of carlbayer.substack.com. You can also see his writing at the People's Policy Project and at Jacobin. Carl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to talk to y'all.
We've had Carl on almost a year ago now, on the wake of the Russian invasion into Ukraine. We're going to talk a little bit about defining anti-war and also the Cy Hirsch revelations. Before we get to Cy Hirsch, this Nord Stream pipeline bombing, I want to know what your reaction is to Carl, because from my perspective, I'm not somebody who's going to get on our platform and say, I know what's going on here. And this is it. And, you know, we've like, especially prior to Hirsch, like, is this, we're the ones who do this. On the other hand, I am also somebody fully ready to believe that America would take an action like this. So I'm just curious what your reaction to the news was.
Yeah. Well, you know, like I've written about this, and the point I've been making over and over again during this war is that nobody really knows what's going on, like half the time, certainly not immediately. We're so used to these sort of rapid response takes and knowing exactly what has happened. And so many pundits are coming into this and just blustering with this absolute certainty and acting like they know what's going on. And I guess, like, I know enough on this topic to know who's bullshitting at the very least and who isn't. And everybody is bullshitting. Almost everybody. There are a handful of people right now who I take seriously as reporters on this, who I think are really being careful and know what they're talking about. But this is the perfect example of this kind of problem, because when that bomb went off and they started covering this, you know, it doesn't seem like it would make sense for Russia to do it this to itself, but it's crazy for the U.S. to do this. I mean, this is an act of war if it happened. And I'm watching the takes roll out and people just being absolutely certain and just trying to work through the logic of, you know, why would anybody do this? So I had no idea, certainly at first, who did it. Very strange stuff has happened in this war, like weirdo false flag operations and stuff like that have actually happened, not as often as a lot of people say they have, but some of that stuff has happened. So you can't just take for granted that Russia didn't do it, although I'm skeptical of that. Mm-hmm. So I sort of have sat back and watched the takes roll in and sort of trying to wrap my head around what's going on and all of that. And the way that I sort of talk about it is I'm kind of keeping a scorecard. And every time that, you know, say somebody makes a convincing point about the U.S. doing it, I add a notch under the U.S. column. Every time somebody makes a convincing point about somebody else, I add a notch there. But this is not something where anybody has really an open shut case still. And my having said all of that, my inclination is to take her seriously. And the narrative that he's laid out sounds plausible to me. I have not been impressed with the criticism I've heard so far of it, though, you know, I'm open to sort of good factual objections, and I do have some questions. But my general inclination is right now to kind of default to, okay, Hirsch is probably onto something. That's my take.
Right. Well,
before we go for just before we go forward, I mean, just want to make sure the whole audience is caught up. I mean, could you just briefly explain like what this bombing is and like why it is such a big deal, like who's behind it and what the potential reasons or madness could be behind, you know, embarking on this?
Right. Sorry. So there are these two Nord Stream pipelines, one and two, that were basically supplying gas from Russia to Europe, or that's sort of the objective, the project they're building. The U.S. has always been very, very opposed to this project because they think that it puts Europe over a barrel where suddenly they're at the mercy of, you know, Russia's willingness to supply them with gas. That's, in my view, that's a credible concern just because whoever could, you know, control of gas is important. And there have been times in the past when Russia has used this as a geopolitical tool. So, for example, I think it was more than a decade ago. It's been a long time, but Russia cutting off gas to Ukraine during the winter years and years ago. And it was over dispute over basically whether they'd paid the bill to Gazprom or not. And eventually they turned it back on. But it's a real concern. You know, if you in terms of, or I wouldn't say concern, but I'll say yes, if you are somebody who does not want Russia to have control over Europe, then that is a thing that you would be paying attention to. Now, whether that actually matters or not is another question. So Biden administration's very skeptical of this project, very opposed to it. Then earlier this, or last year, rather, you know, we wake up one morning and there's a big sort of whirlpool in Baltic Sea where somebody had bombed the pipelines and destroyed them. And this, as far as I can tell, ends the project. It's just not going forward at this point. So as soon as that happens, everybody is pointing fingers at each other. The sort of geopolitics of it, in my view, it makes sense for US or NATO to have done it. It does, or the US has the most incentive to have done it, rather. Russia had good reasons for that not want that to happen. On the other hand, it's crazy because this is not just a Russian project. This is Russian collaboration with Germany and Europe. And bombing that pipeline, like I said earlier, is a act of war on European infrastructure. It's majority owned by Gazprom, but, you know, Europe has a stake in this too, Germany in particular. So just a crazy development. Watching this happen, it's risking the US's alliance with Germany and cooperation with Germany, particularly in this war. It's something that, you know, there's kind of a bit of a divide in Europe. For example, Great Britain didn't really like this project either, but various other, it was complicated. I would say overall that this is just, even if it's just Germany, you know, it's throwing a bomb at German infrastructure. There's an interesting question right now about in what sense this is illegal, actually, which you would look at it and you would think, well, yeah, of course, it's obviously illegal. But there are questions about like jurisdiction, you know, it's sitting in technically international waters, but also in an economic exclusive zone that belongs to, I believe, Norway and Sweden. It is illegal to damage pipelines, but strangely, it is it, the this kind of attack is not sort of legislated against in the same way, and there are precedents for prosecuting this kind of attack elsewhere. But it's a very, it's the Biden administration just stepping on this massive landmine with really unpredictable consequences. And it boggles my mind that they would actually do this, but that's what the evidence is leaning towards, it seems.
Yeah, Hirschmanson's some comments in the form of, I think that is fairly persuasive circumstantial evidence from, you know, Joe Biden saying we have ways to end that. Victoria Nuland, I listened to Hirsch on Radio Warner, and there, and I think Mark made the point of like early on Europe, maybe it was Germany or someone from Europe said, like, if there was an attack on infrastructure, that our response would be united. And then I think Hirsch said, or maybe it was Ames saying, like, well, it's united in silence. And I feel like, you know, I just talk about that dynamic of this, because it does feel like, I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself and just say like America did it, but like, that is like, that's a big political problem for Germans, for instance, especially if all of a sudden gas prices go up as it gets colder.
Yeah. Well, I think that the way we have to think about this is that there are really sort of two levels of knowledge about this out there. On one hand, you have, and Hirsch mentions this, you have actual sort of people who work with pipelines, manufacturers and stuff like that. You also have insurance companies. He didn't mention this. I talked to actually a Russian friend brought this up to me, where he was interested in the insurance companies. And of course, they would want to know what happened here and have questions about liability and all that. And they would be investigating. And then, of course, you have sort of people, you have intelligence services in all of the relevant countries who are going to be looking at this and trying to find out what happens. So you have this layer of people actually, you know, what actually happened, people trying to understand what actually happened. And then on top of that, you have this diplomatic layer of what we're willing to admit happened or what we will say happened. And what's, I mean, it's always very difficult to speculate about all the considerations that are going into this, because it's more complicated than people like to suggest. You know, people, I think Great Britain is the example. People just sort of take for granted that Great Britain will do whatever the U.S. wants it to do. And that's true 99% of the time, but there is a 1% of the time where they'll butt heads. Germany is even more sort of in tension with the U.S. over these issues. About a decade or so ago, Germany and France were cautioning the U.S. against bringing Ukraine into NATO. That was a recurring stance that they were taking, and that was back when Hillary Clinton and John McCain were putting forward resolutions in Congress during the Bush administration, saying that we should bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. Barack Obama co-sponsored that, by the way, as well. So there was a lot of sort of bipartisan interest in doing that, and very, very little opposition, very, very little attention to that problem. I remember writing about Hillary Clinton's sort of efforts to bring Ukraine into NATO during her election. I still have an article floating out about there in 2016, and absolutely no one was talking about it. And I was just, I mean, this is the kind of thing I had in mind. What's going on right now? This was pushing us towards a conflict that was going to happen sooner or later. So anyway, we have these two, we have this layer of diplomacy going on top. And I think Germany is, they're obviously playing ball right now about this. I think probably part of the problem is that nobody is complete. Like, you don't want to throw out an accusation that the United States did this unless you are 100% sure. You know, even 99% isn't good enough. If you're Germany, you need to know. So that could be part of it, why they're holding off just that. There may be sort of diplomatic and political retaliation going on under the table where they are not openly blaming the US, but then, you know, when they're like, for example, when NATO is trying to bring in more military aid to Ukraine, you know, Germany may very well be like, you know, a little cool on it before, and this is why. So I think that something like that is going on. It is right. It is crazy that the US is that something like this is able to happen, and Germany, a country that large, just is sort of ducking its head down and isn't even voicing suspicions about the US, because you don't, even if they find out that the US did it, I'm not convinced that they will actually make a public statement about it or make a big problem about it. Maybe it will come out eventually, but they may just decide, okay, you know, you dicked us over here. This is a serious problem for their economy. And there will be a political fallout for that, but there's kind of, especially in the middle of a war, there's kind of a different consequence for Germany coming out and openly saying, yes, the US did that. Suddenly that gives Russia diplomatic cover for retaliation and, you know, stuff like that. So I think they have stuff like that in mind.
Right. I mean, we should say, like, as you point out in your blog, which we'll link to, Russia accused the UK originally. So, like, there is, like, some uncertainty going around about this.
Oh, yeah. So that's a very funny dynamic here that's just going completely overlooked. And, you know, like, I really encourage everybody, your listeners here, to just look back. And I believe it was in May it was in September. It was August or September when Russia started loudly accusing the British Navy of doing this. And as soon as they started doing that, then instantly you had a whole swath of pundits saying, yep, there, you know, there it is. British Navy did it. And, you know, like I was complaining about earlier, just doing it with this absolute certitude, like, it's obvious they did it. And now everybody's quietly changed their story and not acknowledging that. You know, the thing is, like, what strikes me about the story of Hirsch's is there is no mention of UK involvement whatsoever. And I wouldn't take for granted that the UK was involved here. The US was obviously sort of collaborating with Nordic states here, but we have no reason to believe that they, I mean, there's no reason to bring the UK in the loop on this. You know, and so that also fed into when Russia was making that accusation, you know, everybody was very certain that Great Britain did it because that let them say, okay, Great Britain doesn't do anything unless the US tells them to. So that was the big rush to incriminate Great Britain. But what I think that should tell everybody, number one, is that just so many people are bullshitting about this. Like, it's unbelievable. We do not have this vast pundit class of people who are experts in seabed warfare and stuff like, it's stupid. It's nobody knows this stuff. I mean, or, you know, like the international law considerations of, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this because, like I mentioned, it's not international waters. It's international waters, but it's also this exclusive economic zone. And it's difficult to say, you know, if the US were to be incriminated here, how would it even be prosecuted, who would have some kind of legal standing. There, it's such a bizarre situation. So that change in narrative was a big tell for a lot of things. It was also a big tell because it proved that Russia really didn't know what was going on. And yet they were just throwing around accusations of an act of war against Great Britain, which, as far as we know, is a completely innocent country. That is so dangerous and irresponsible. I'm baffled by how credulous everybody has been about all of this. And it's about, it's about with Hirsch too. Because in his interview with Ames, you probably heard this, there's a point where Mark is asking him about public skepticism of this. And he says, he's like, well, yeah, I would expect people to have questions about, say, the sourcing and stuff like that, because of course, in this media environment, you would. But I would also expect them to really think about it and to sort of look at the stuff that they can investigate. So, for example, we know that Biden and Nuland made these statements. You can verify that for yourself, and you can think about it for yourself and say, okay, well, if the U.S. did not do this, then why did they say what they said? So it's funny. Even Hirsch is this old school journalist who is in love with critical thinking, and he wants people to be skeptical and all that. But every single time a new Hirsch article drops, you have the sort of national security establishment and whatever party is being disadvantaged by this bombshell, all of its partisans instantly say he's not credible, he's a liar, we can't believe it. And then you have the symmetrical backlash where people are just credulously believing everything he says. I'm inclined to believe it because it makes perfect sense to me. The details sound very plausible to me, but at the end of the day, we're going to have to wait and see if there's any sort of corroboration that emerges.
I've really appreciated Hirsch's comments on a lot of things like that. Like the openness of this is on, he's not like asking like the readers to go like throw themselves in front of like the American war machine. You're saying the New York Times should get out their ass and do some reporting on this sort of thing.
That's the thing. I mean, and just to talk about the outlets that have covered this, this is from Responsible Statecraft. I mean, like the thing that's really notable about this story has been just generally other than like the condemnations on Twitter in terms of like mainstream news, like the lack of interest in even sort of investigating this. Like this is from the Quincy Institute, Responsible Statecraft, Bloomberg, the French press, the Times in the UK, the New York Post, covered it briefly. Newsweek covered it, but the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, BBC, The Guardian, and most German newspapers, have completely ignored it in a way that is very strange. I think because without like, if before the Hirsch, information, came out, or his allegations came out, we're all sort of in the sense of like, oh, it's sort of, confusing. We don't really know. We can have like general suspicions or whatever. If nothing, this should be something that is encouraging people who might disagree with Hirsch, say that he's lying or whatever, to say that like there should be more investigation into this very serious event that happened.
Right. That sort of plays into the point that I made in my post about this, which is that there, one avenue of congressional investigation here, because that's one of the only avenues we have to look into this, is to dig into this legal rationale that Hirsch brought up. Hirsch says that allegedly the administration's reasoning was that because of the statements that Biden and Nuland made, the operation was no longer covert. It was just classified, which means that they did not have to inform Congress. So one simple question that you could ask about this if you are in Congress is just ask the Biden administration, would those comments, is it the position of the administration that those comments would have sufficed to decovert, or whatever the term is, turn it from not declassified because it was still classified, but make it from a covert operation to a non-covert operation. Would those comments have been sufficient to change the legal status of it? And yeah, this is a hypothetical. They aren't going to admit that they did it one way or another, but if you can get the administration to take a position on this hypothetical, it puts them in a situation of either having to protect themselves from legal exposure by saying, well, yeah, we didn't do this, but if we said this, it would have covered us. You know, they would be saying something shady like that. Mm-hmm. If they didn't do this, then they have zero stake in defending that legal argument. And they can just say, no, that wouldn't have defended us. So that's the kind of investigation that I think can be done. Obviously, you know, the administration's going to say stuff like, we don't answer hypotheticals to reporters. But if you get them, before the House, House committee, or something like that, then yeah, you may be able to corner them into answering that question. And if you do, then even people who have been inclined to support this war would nevertheless probably want to pursue this, simply because Congress has become increasingly assertive about its power over declarations of war and that sort of thing, over military operations and stuff like that, there, which is a good thing in my view. They're getting more possessive about that again. And so they would, just for the sake of asserting their own power, and if they have a very self-interested stake in wanting to get to the bottom of that question. So, you know, you can have somebody like AOC who is, who I don't think has been great on this war in terms of supporting military action and stuff like that. But I think that you probably could get her on board with pursuing that line of investigation, mm-hmm. at least. And if you can't, you know, if you can't get her, get talk to Ilhan Omar. If you can't get her, you know, get one of these opportunistic, cynical Republicans who just want to screw over Biden. Get one of them to do it. I'm fine with, you know, that's the kind of left-right cooperation that I'm fine with. They, we should want that to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Before I get to the left-right cooperation and being truly anti-war, I just want to, like, you end your piece with, you know, I'm glad I'm not in major cities now, and putting this in the context of Osama bin Laden raid and Trump's killing of the generals, the Soleimani. Just talk about that. Like this is stuff that we need to get to the bottom of, because, like, whether or not, like, the Germans admit it or not, the perception that we're acting like this way puts us all in danger.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we all know that the U.S. has always done these little special op things below the radar and denied it, and, you know, it's illegal most of the time and all that. That's not news. But what's like this trend that I'm seeing here is that they're doing these ops that are actually extremely, extremely high risk. Geopolitically. So not just in terms of, you know, soldiers getting caught or the mission failing or whatever, but in terms of starting big wars. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that the drone strike on Soleimani was one of the most irresponsible acts of a president in modern history until this happened. And now Biden's giving Trump a run for his money if that went on. So you have this, you know, I think if you sort of put this in a historical context, the U.S. is losing its hegemony over the rest of the world. And to sort of maintain its power, it's having to take these increasingly risky chances on stuff like this. And eventually it's going to come back and bite us. When I lived in D.C. and I was there during the war on terror and all of that, like I was never too worried about that stuff. But right now, there really is a good reason to believe that Russia would retaliate against something like this. It's not impossible. That kind of thing can happen. It might not, even if it doesn't start a nuclear war, even if they don't start launching missiles or whatever, I still wouldn't want to be walking around the hill right now. I wouldn't want to be in New York right now. Fortunately, I am out in the middle of nowhere in rural Virginia. But that my point is that this kind of thing should scare Americans. This kind of irresponsibility, you know, not the terrorists, but our presidents putting us in danger over and over again like this. This is something that is terrifying. Mm-hmm.
You have anything you want to say, David, before we move on to the anti-war stuff?
No, I mean, other than I do highly suggest people read Carl's piece, which we'll link to, because I think it walks a good line between, you know, sprinting and necessarily believing everything Hirsch is saying.
I mean, there's an incentive from people in like our business to be like, yep, and we're the ones who also know it. And we know it before Democracy Now! Does. So look at us.
That is kind of that has actually been like, I think for my part, I have seen this where like, if I had been really, really assertive on a lot of things that have happened and just, you know, it's rolling the dice and maybe I would have been proven right. So like, for example, the Bucha massacre is a good example of something where, Bucha, a Ukrainian friend corrected me about that recently, Bucha massacre. I was, when that first happened, I didn't know what to think. My inclination was to assume that Russians probably did this, but then you had sort of, you know, like this weird windshield footage of a corpse supposedly waving his hand, and that turned out, you know, you had all of this uncertainty and you had people coming out and just absolutely for sure saying, yeah, Russia did it, or yeah, Ukraine did it. And if I were a gambler, then I probably could have just been like, yeah, of course Russia did it, and I would have been right. But I really, like, I feel this moral responsibility to be careful about throwing around accusations of war crimes and throwing around, you know, imagine, like, the Great Britain thing is a good example. People who were blaming Great Britain for this, I think should really be re-examining themselves, and the fact that they were putting this whole nation in danger over a act of war that they did not actually engage in. Right. Like, that's obscene. That's really dangerous. So
justifying retaliation, basically.
Yeah. So there's this really terrible media dynamic right now where that's driving people to project certitude and act really irresponsibly in their analysis, just because that's what gets the clicks. That's what establishes you as some kind of authority if you happen to luck out and get it right. And, you know, if you get it wrong, nobody remembers anyway. So you might as well just be certain.
Exactly. So let's move I don't want to get too much into the maybe we can, this anti-war rally, so-called, where you have basically people who are pro-Russian invasion. And I do appreciate, like, and you mentioned earlier, the actual left to right anti-war alliance includes yourself on the left, the Libertarian Party on the right and, let's say, Michael Tracy in the middle, wondering why we're inviting people who are just enthusiastic supporters of the invasion to an anti-war rally. Can you just talk about that? And then what should be like the left socialist position on this war? And like, we talked to you, I don't imagine your position has changed so much since a year ago, but I'm just curious to like reiterate some of those points.
Yeah. So, you know, during the Iraq war, we did have kind of similar-ish controversies about, should we ally with libertarians? Should we bring this or that person in? And that's just an eternal question of the anti-war movement. That's not going to be resolved this time, and it's not going to go away. I don't worry too much about that kind of thing. And I understand why people might disagree over who people have different lines. But just the fact that you have people who are openly pro-war saying explicitly, I am not anti-war. It's not even controversial that they support the Russian military and Russian militarism here. The only question is, you have people trying to make hilarious arguments about how that's actually an anti-war position to support Russian troops gunning people down. And, you know, I guess like my thought is, okay, well, if you want to call that an anti-war position, can we have a new term for the thing where you don't want anybody to shoot anybody? Because that's what I am. I, you know, call anti-war whatever you want, but I'm one of these guys who actually does not want innocent civilians murdered under any circumstances. So you have multiple people involved in this rally who have been taking those wildly irresponsible positions. You have people involved with the rally, like the Libertarian Party, who get it and who are saying, you know, why are these people on stage? And it's all just political. It's like, I'm tempted to say it's activist politics, but it's really more media politics, because there are only two organizations. The Green Party voted to endorse Rage Against the War Machine by a very slim vote, two votes, and Jill Stein's there. You have, I forget what his name is, it slipped my mind, but you have the guy from World Beyond War who's also there. So those are, you can call both of those real membership organizations. Whether you want to called sort of Jimmy Dore's People's Party thing a membership organization, I think that's more controversial. I think that mostly lives online. And that seems more like a media fandom than anything to me. So what's really going on here is that you have this clique of pundits and, you know, then some officials or some politicians who haven't been in office in years, and who, you know, a lot of these people very much have been on the right side of anti-war protests, like a lot of times over the years, and all respect to them, but they don't speak for everybody. They can't speak for everybody. They're not part of membership organizations. There's no accountability here. And so when they do stuff like invite random weirdos and it comes out that these guys are actually pro-war, there's no accountability. And these people have all kinds of perverse incentives to keep them on board. Keep these pro-war voices on board. So I've from the beginning of this war, I thought that I was going to be spending the whole war defending myself against accusations that I'm some kind of Kremlin bot and stuff like that, because my position is anti-war and I don't want the US over there. I thought that's all I was going to be doing. And incredibly, I am finding myself facing that and facing accusations that I'm some kind of NATO shill, because I also don't want Russia in there murdering people, murdering innocent civilians. They aren't all Nazis, you know. Some of these are, I mean, most of these are just normal working class Ukrainians who are getting gunned down, who are getting, you know, we're seeing apartment bombings building, we're seeing crucial infrastructure being deliberately bombed, like those power line bombings earlier this year. I oppose that too. And so I found myself having to push back against that insane current that we're seeing in this rally that is pro-war, pro-Russian war. So I've been really, I've been really heartened by the response that I've seen to this. Even, you know, like, for example, you have this alternative rally coming up, like with the Answer Coalition and Code Pink. A lot of, they have a whole list of sort of longstanding anti-war groups who have been doing this forever. And I've been very heartened to see them stay away from that kind of rhetoric and understand that there is a problem with it. But this isn't complicated. Like you said, like even the Libertarian Party and even Michael Tracy gets the madness of putting pro-war voices on the stage. And, you know, I don't know how seriously to take Tracy's opposition to it, because some of this is also media politics. He's sparring with Tara Reid because she's mad about his skepticism of the Biden stuff. So they've been going back and forth, and you can see Tara Reid taunting Tracy and saying, "You're just mad because you weren't invited." So that's the level of like pettiness that is going into like who gets invited, who don't. You have at the Black Agenda Report, there is an article accusing this rally of all kinds of racism and bigotry and transphobia. And there are a lot of speakers there. There are too many speakers there for who those are credible accusations. But one of the truly damning points that it made in there was just that a lot of the major left anti-war groups were not invited to speak at this rally, were not invited to participate. I've asked around and I've just heard silence. This does not sound to me like a group that wants to expand the anti-war coalition. Like, I'm sorry, if you aren't calling Answer and trying to bring them into your anti-war coalition, if you aren't even inviting them, then you aren't serious. You can invite them, and then if they say, no, we aren't because you guys are racists or whatever, okay, well, then you can have that conversation. But if you aren't even inviting them, there's just no credibility to a group that's not reaching out to the left in the same way that they will take whatever insane LaRoucheites and
which is an amazing thing to come back.
The people, some woman whose thing is like crypto is going to be on stage. Like, it's a bizarre lineup.
Well, I mean, it's I don't know. It's just like it's truly like I think it's sad and it's incredibly cynical. And as you said, like, the fact that like not only is it media figures in the sense of like, oh, that's, you know, we can understand the motivations for some people wanting to participate in something like that, but it also shows that they're, you know, it's not a serious political movement in the sense that like anybody, even people, you know, who do media like us would say that like any kind of movement rally that is just a bunch of media figures like Hawk and whatever their program is probably not something that's set up to be an effective mobilization of like the people against something.
I mean, you know, you've got to put up like the Roger Waters type guys, like sort of the celebrity people to bring the crowds in and stuff like that. But you know, a lot of this is like a sort of panel of like C or D tier media micro celebrities. And it's just sort of a click. That's not going to bring in mobs. That, you know, the anti-war movement isn't going to rally around Jackson Hinkle.
No, like, but I mean, what it will do is be very effective for them all to say is like, oh, look who's not here. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, look, the DSA is not here. Bernie Sanders isn't here. We told you they were liars, you know. Yeah, exactly.
Well, yes, this is the same group who the People's Party did the Medicare for All rally, where they said we can't really trust the government to be in charge of this.
Yeah, and this is, and you know, this is the thing. Like, that's a good point about how those kind of lines about, you know, oh, the DSA isn't here. Oh, you know, all these left groups aren't here, like. Constantly, one piece of rhetoric that you will see from these speakers over and over is a broad brush generalization about the left. The left isn't anti-war anymore. The left is imperialist. Like, you know, all of this. That is not how you talk to people who you want to bring into your coalition. I'm a leftist. I do not want the U.S. in Ukraine. And I also don't want to work with somebody who's constantly telling everybody I'm pro-war. That's like who's lying about that. That's completely understandable that you wouldn't want to work with somebody like that. And it's completely unnecessary to be saying that unless what you're really doing is trying to sort of assert this weird monopoly on the anti-war position and scooch anybody who disagrees with you for ideological reasons, like has narrow ideological disagreements, or who just aren't in your sort of media cohort, like to push them out.
No, we can work with the right, but we can't work with the left, you know. But we're also the one true leftist, you know what I mean? Like, I think that does betray a lot of that position.
Yeah, I mean, the whole degree of tolerance of what this rally is willing to put up from the right versus like what it's willing to put up for the left is ridiculous.
Well, it's always funny there, like the purity, because I'll admit I don't like and am troubled by like Bandera stuff and like the nationalism in the Ukraine, but like that doesn't mean like all of a sudden look past like Oath Keepers and, right, like, it's just bizarre.
Yeah. And, you know, there's another element, too. I don't want to make too much of this, but, you know, Chris Hedges wrote a little piece for Alternate sort of defending his participation in the war. And he said, you know, of course, I wouldn't rally with Oath Keepers or with neo-Nazis or stuff like that. So he does have a line. Mm-hmm. And there are several other speakers and people who've defended the war who have said the same thing. So they do have lines, too. So this is about where you draw the line, not about purity. It's just about where you draw the line. And the thing is that, you know, Chris Hedges is, how old is he now? Like, is he in his 70s yet?
That's a good question.
I reckon so. I mean, not trying to be rude to Chris.
Yeah, no. There's 66. Wrong with that.
No, I know. Yeah.
Okay, so Chris Hedges is 66. You know, there are other people who I could name who are older. These people don't know who Jackson Hinkle are because
you're very right about that too. Yeah. I think there is a whole part of this conversation that some of these folks really don't have any understanding or interaction with. I think that's
It's insane, like watching, you know, what the sort of peak of this whole affair to me is that one of the director of the Ron Paul Institute, who is one of the major speakers of the war, started suggesting that Michael Tracy's kind of a little soft on Russiagate here. because this is like Rushgate. I'm just like, if you are accusing Michael Tracy of all people of buying into this kind of Russophobia, you know, say what you will about him, but yeah. This has been like his hobby horse for years and years now. And, you know, so you have, especially like among the rank and file, just throwing around these accusations that such and such person who's been in the anti-war movement forever, CIA, media Benjamin is FBI, mm-hmm. you know, like all these wild Fed jacketing attacks on longtime left anti-war activists. Of course, we don't want to work with people doing that to us. And yeah. They don't want to work with us. They're making that perfectly clear.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes you think maybe it's an accident that all these people are getting fed jacketed and smeared by the right. Maybe that's actually part of the goal here.
Okay, the right definitely has this incentive right now to sort of try to monopolize the anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. Like the libertarian right does. And you can see that over and over in the way that like media people talk about it. And, you know, like Glenn Greenwald is the big one who's just like anti-war is on the right now, not on the left. And constantly, you know, he'll make a categorical claim like that. And then as soon as five people jump in his mentions and say, well, what about this leftist? What about that leftist? He'll say, oh, well, you know, I don't mean all of them. Like go back. But over and over again, we are seeing this effort to discredit the left on war and give the right this monopoly on anti-war opposition. And, you know, it's a problem because, like we saw the other day, congressional Republicans are already working to expand the budget in Ukraine and sort of trying to decide how they're going to navigate that question. They're making the exact mistake that they constantly accuse the left of, which is just associating position and partisanship or whatever with anti-war. Like, that's what they're doing.
Carl Bayer.substack.com will include a link to this piece. Thank you so much, Bayer, for
discussing this. Yep. Oh, absolutely. Glad to talk to you.